You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam, with this week's edition of News and Review, Just Ask the Press. And as always with me is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and White House chief correspondent from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. This week, we're going to be unraveling quite a bit. Donald Trump, he says this tower will never be captured, but the Trump Tower in New York is up for capture. There's violence on the U.S. southern border between immigrants and Texas folks. Biden leads Trump in the money, but does he lead him in the polls? Ronna McDaniel is now on NBC. There is a budget that has been passed. And of course, the shooting and the fire and the problems in Russia. So that and a lot more to unravel. Stick around. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with this edition of Just Ask the Press as we take a look at the news and review what has happened during this past week and look ahead. We're going to start out with the Donald Trump situation in New York. He has said something on Truth Social that said, you know, hey, he's got money and by gum, he's not going to give up Trump Tower, but he's been unable to post a bond. More than 30 insurance companies have turned him down for the bond. And so on Monday, tomorrow, Letitia James could begin activities that would seize Trump Tower, to which he, of course, has said no one will ever take Trump Tower alive. And to unravel that and to lead us into that menagerie, Michael, it's all yours. Let's ask the question. Can she take it?
I don't think he owns it, so it's not easy to just take it. It's not like an individual's car that they own outright. It's more like a car that's owned by a finance company or a bank or something. So there are multiple sort of owners of the property. But if the proposition is, if in order to appeal, you not need to post a bond, and if you can't post the bond, you can't appeal. That's one thing. The other thing is, if you have a debt and you need to pay the debt and you don't have the cash reserves to pay the debt, then that person who is owed the money can collect. You see people on the street in neighborhoods across the country being thrown out of their homes because they're being collected against. And so in this case, there is an entitlement, if he wants to go forward, to collect on the debt. And that could mean trying to seize property or take over his interest in property. And I mean, he could choose lots of different routes here, including what he says he has, which is $500 million in cash. That's what he said on Truth Social. So, I mean, if he has the cash, he could put it up and avoid the seizures. If he has a certain amount of cash and can't get all of his own cash, he can try to get a bond for a portion of the cash. But if he can't do all of that, and he has an obligation to pay, then in some sense, he stands in no different position than anybody else who has a debt, that has a debt collector asking for the repayment.
It says
it's not a very complicated process, really.
Well, it says the assets such as buildings, houses, cars, helicopters, and his plane are in play. They were looking at a upstate property and one of his golf courses. But they said the main focus could be on his bank accounts, which experts say will be easier to take hold of, and properties, which would be more difficult. He's asked the state appeals court to allow him to post a smaller bond or none at all, claiming he could face irreparable harm if he were forced to sell properties at a fire sale that can't be undone if he ultimately wins his appeal. The court has not yet ruled on his Truth Social. And this is, I'd love to get your take on this one, John. Throughout hard work, talent, and luck, I have currently have almost $500 million in cash, a substantial amount of which I intended to use in my campaign for president. He's behind in fundraising. Anyway, that's kind of, I think he's throwing that in there for political reasons. The often overturned political hack judge on the rigged and corrupt AG case, where I've done nothing wrong, knew this, wanted to take it away from me, and that's where and why he came up with a shocking number, which, coupled with his crazy interest demand, is approximately $454 million. I did nothing wrong except win an election 2016 that I wasn't expected to win, did even better in 2020, and now lead by a lot in 2024. This is communism in America. Isn't this just Donald Trump campaigning?
It's always Donald Trump campaigning. And I believe that was in all caps. It was a
Yes, it
number.
was.
And you can tell kind of what mood he's in when he goes with a string of all caps Truth Social posts. I used to say, Brian, and I think you felt this too, that when Trump was in the White House, you could feel the mood of the place. You could feel his mood. The walls literally oozed.
Oozed.
If he was pissed off or feeling pretty good about things, and you could see it on his staff members' faces. I mean, they wore it. They didn't, if you were around it enough, you could really get a feel of what was going on in the
It
Oval. It wasn't that
didn't take
hard.
much,
And
did
no. And the same thing with, these interviews that he does and his Truth Social posts and sometimes the rallies. But yeah, this is him campaigning. Why would you send your lawyers to write up a court filing and give it to the judge and say you don't have the liquid cash to pay the 400, I believe $54 million is what it was up to at my last check, and then a couple days later write on your social media platform that you have more than the $454 million you owe it, that. I assume there will be a hearing about this at some point, and I guess the judge is going to have to ask that question that plainly, like, well, Mr. Trump, do you have the money or not? And if you do, we would like it. And but you may want to, your next question might be, what does this, how does this matter at all, and how much in the presidential election? And at least right now, I don't think it does. I don't know how much this is resonating right now with independent voters. I can say, being back full time covering the presidency, that the incumbent president Joe Biden was on a southwest swing last week to Nevada, Arizona, and Texas, raising money. He had some official events, and at every stop, he went right at Donald Trump. He's talking about Trump differently. He's saying his name, which he didn't do really the first 2.5 years, 3 years in office, and being very critical, talking, in very dire terms about Trump and overturning the trying to overturn the election and the vengeance tour that Trump's on and what a second term would be, and this is a shift definitely for the president. I don't know that this is registering right now with those independent voters in those six states that are going to decide this thing. But if Biden and company stay on that message, and especially when Trump starts being required to appear in court, maybe almost every day, at least a few days a week, maybe in multiple trials, if they can get these things started, then I think it can. You're going to love this one. It can have the potential to start resonating with independent voters, and that's going to matter. You've got Arab Americans, Black Americans, Latino American, Hispanic Americans are frustrated with Biden, so he's got to get big numbers of independents in case members of those groups, vote for the Green Party or a third party candidate, write someone in, write in uncommitted like they did in Michigan. So this can matter. I just don't think it is yet.
Well, I'm curious, and Michael, maybe you can clear it up. I mean, Trump Tower will never be captured. I mean, legally, it's not about it's misstating the obvious legalities, isn't it? I mean, he lost. He's got to post a bond. It's not different from him than anyone else. And he's trying to create an, I mean, to your point, John, he's just trying to create a political, he's trying to create something he can campaign on. And this is really more about, and there are people who are saying, look, if he takes, if he loses this, it kind of eradicates or erases the idea that Donald Trump is, you know, the Teflon Don. It'll be the first crack in his armor. But you can tell me better than anyone else. Legally, this is not unheard of, right? This is the process.
Yes, it's basic blocking and tackling. But there
I
is a.
appreciate that, and there's a good football reference. Go ahead.
But you know, I th there one always has to think about the system also in cases like this. And you know, there's a lot of criticism about the bond system on the criminal justice side, how individuals can't make bond if they're poor, and they get held in jail pre-trial way too often because the bond system is just an antiquated, broken system, which needs to be fixed. And so while this is not that, you do wonder whether or not if a person truly can't come up with $500 million, which is an awful lot of money to come up with,
That's a bigger
is
budget
there,
than some small countries, but go ahead, yeah.
right, is there some other mechanism in place that allows the person to pursue their entitlement to an appeal without, you know, bankrupting themselves? Is the So I think one has to ask the question, is there something broken about the system? That does this reveal something broken about the system? Whether you like Trump or don't like Trump, whether you think he should pay all this money in the end or not, is there something that has to be looked at, divorced from people's position on Donald Trump? And it does raise questions about the system in my mind, that somehow someone is going to be denied their right to an appeal because they can't meet financial conditions. That just it just historically, it raises all sorts of, you know, red flags about of discrimination. I'm not suggesting for a moment that Donald Trump is anywhere like an indigent African American defendant who's held pretrial because he can't come up with bond. That's not the
No,
analogy I'm trying to
Trump will make
draw.
that analogy himself, but go
No,
ahead.
but I'm not trying to draw that analogy. I'm just trying to say the whole bond system needs to be looked at some point, you know, quite independent of Trump, but maybe Trump is a catalyst for looking at whether or not this system is fair.
Well, and that's a fair point taken. But if there is a two-tier justice system in the United States, I don't think, although Trump makes the argument, I don't think he's on that lower tier.
Well, and the thing about it is, if you read the articles that purport to know what is the situation here, it is that, as I said, these properties, these real estate holdings that Trump owns are not owned by him outright. They're owned by him and venture capital groups and others. And the question is, what is his stake worth? How much of a true ownership interest does he have? How much is he indebted to others? Has this been used to collateralize other loans? So it's really not clear. That's why taking the property is probably pretty complicated, because I'm sure he's got partners in
Right.
this that would object to the trying to take a piece of property that they own a half interest in to be sold at some fire sale. And so maybe they're saying to Trump, you know, you need money, I'll buy out your interest, you know, pennies on the dollar. And he's refusing to do that. And so he's not sort of really being transparent about what it is that he's actually been putting up as collateral. So, I mean, I'm sure that The
gaming
idea
the
of Trump not
system.
being transparent, though, I mean, come on. That's a stretch, isn't
Yes, it's a bit of a it's a bit hyperbolic for sure,
it?
but you know what I'm saying is that he might not be transparent. He may not be transparent about what it is that he's actually putting up, or willing to put up, or the terms under which people are willing to accept it. He might be saying, the insurance companies might be saying to him, look, sure, we'll put up the bond, but here are the conditions that we want from you. And he's saying, I'm not going to agree to those conditions. And then he's saying, to the court, I can't find the bond without explaining why he can't find the bond.
Right.
So we'll hear. I think there's going to be hearings on this coming up.
Yep.
And not to be confused with the hearings that, the Congress will hold to try to pillory brag or in some way,
Yeah, that's not to be confused with the crap that they'll have to go through in Congress. But
Well, one.
go ahead, John.
Yeah, I wanted to give a plug to Mary Curtis. She's a roll call columnist, among other jobs that Mary has. And she wrote a column this week. Listeners can find it at rollcall.com about that very notion that Trump pushed of the two-tiered justice system. And Mary made the point, as only she can, that when Black Americans think of a two-tiered justice system, they have a very different idea of how that works or doesn't work for Black Americans. It hasn't worked for them for a long time, and she makes the point that it's insulting for Trump to say he's the victim of a two-tier justice systems when Black Americans have had such a struggle with over-incarceration and a lot of other issues with the justice system. So everybody should check out Mary's column. It's very well done.
Right. And that's the point, John, that I'm trying to make is that I'm
Yeah.
not analogizing Trump to those indigent defendants who are being
Right.
held in prison pretrial because of a bond system that's
Yeah.
broken. But I'm just saying is the issue of bond, the macro issue of our bond system has a very sordid history.
Yeah.
And one has to just think about it in those terms and not suffer, entirely from, some sort of Trump derangement syndrome where he should get what he deserves, irrespective of the policy that gives rise to this particular
Right.
situation.
I wouldn't argue against any of that. All I'm saying at the end of the day is that Donald Trump will skate as long as he can, and you got to be careful how he skates. And that brings up the issue one in his Truth Social posting that he was going to spend this $500 million on his campaign. And John, as you pointed out before, Biden leads Trump in money but is behind in the polls. So does the traditional money, I've got the most money, I can win type of thing that everyone assumes is the dynamic and the metric in the election, does that hold true with Donald Trump?
Well, what's hard to measure is, and we were talking about this the other day, Brian. What's hard to measure, especially with Trump, we found this in 2016, didn't we? Is the enthusiasm that Republicans have for Trump. And I reject kind of the premise of this notion that gets said, on television or by lawmakers, that it's just the base that's enthusiastic about Trump. I think it goes beyond that. I think a lot of folks who might not be self-described card-carrying MAGA members in the Republican Party, when they're at home watching Fox News and or watching a Trump part of a Trump rally or something, I think they're pumping their fist on their couch. I think they're with this guy, and he's got a huge fundraising deficit to Joe Biden. Our colleagues at The Hill, Brett Samuels and Amy Parnes, had a really good story this week about that. And and at the time of that writing, I think they published that story maybe Tuesday. Biden has a hunt one hunt over $100 million advantage right now, cash on hand, campaign cash on hand, and that was before Those numbers, I don't believe, captured Biden's fundraising last 2 weeks ago in Michigan and Wisconsin, and it definitely didn't capture what he raised on his
This week.
Southwest tour this week.
Yeah.
So it's bigger now. Trump didn't do any fundraisers that I'm aware of this week. So it should matter. And I think I've said this before, the indicators are all over the place right now. You want to look at, try to measure enthusiasm. Well, that's Trump. That box in Trump's column. In the other column, stuff like fundraising, if you just look at that, then you're thinking, wow, Biden's probably going to win this thing, right? Because money matters. Those digital ads, radio ads, videos that they produce for social media, those aren't cheap by any means. So you look at that and you think, oh, Biden's going to probably walking across the finish line. But then you go look at the latest poll and the latest CNN poll, I believe it was out Friday, Trump's up 8 points nationally. So then you think, oh, Trump's going to win this thing. So it's just, which, and all that tells me, all these indicators being all over the place tells me it's probably a dead heat right now, which is
Michael.
remarkable because Trump is down over $100 million and he's still leading in the polls. Maybe it won't matter. Maybe it's just going to come down to these two old white guys lobbing insults back and forth in October, and somebody's going to, so the ref is going to raise somebody's hand and hand them the belt at the end of this fight, and who knows right now? Who knows?
Michael.
Well, as we talk, I'm looking at the latest polls, and I think to John's point, this really looks to be a dead heat at this point in the general election, and even on the key battleground states, they are running within margin of error on almost every poll. And it will then come down to what you pointed out, Brian, which is turnout of key constituencies within each of the party's base. And we know that Trump's base will come out. The Democratic base is less clear because of issues like the Middle East that affect Arab American voters, because issues at the border, which affect Hispanic voters, with the economy, and in some cases religious matters for African American voters, Southern Baptists, a pretty conservative group. And so the question is, in the end, how will these voters act in the voting booth? And the congresswoman, whose name I'm just forgetting, the Palestinian Congresswoman Illy Anna, well, no, from Michigan.
Oh, I know here, but go ahead.
One, who's been very outspokenly critical of the administration's policy in support of Israel in Gaza, was asked, well, given this, will you vote for Biden? And she said, of course, because democracy is on the ballot. So she may be, an instigator of the
Are you talking about
anyone.
Rashida Tlaib?
Yeah, Tlaib.
Okay. All
I
right.
think it was her, Tlaib. So she said, democracy is on the ballot. And so she may support a mo a symbolic primary anyone but candidate protest vote. But what she says is, when it comes down to Trump versus Biden in the general election,
Yeah.
of course I'm voting for Biden. Well, she's a Democrat, but of course I'm voting for Biden, because democracy is on the ballot. And so the question is that going to be the way it is? Are people who are going to say, I'm really disturbed about Gaza, I'm really disturbed about immigration, I'm really disturbed about inflation, going to get into the ballot box and say, yeah, but I'm also very concerned about democracy, and I'll take these short-term Gaza, immigration, inflation hits in order to preserve our democracy. And that, I don't think, is the case that Biden has to make. In addition to the conditions are improving. Remember H.W. Bush, when he lost to Clinton, sort of remarked, I think, somewhere that had the election been held like a month or two later, when the economy finally turned the corner, then the Clinton, it's the economy's stupid message, would have fallen flatter. But elections are held when elections are set, and he lost. And so the question here is, will Biden run out of time before the economy, improves substantially, and it'll be, a day late, dollar short for him.
Well, I think the bottom line, those people that are disaffected and discombobulated, are they going to vote at all, or are they going to vote third party and go pull the handle for, Robert Kennedy Jr. and Aaron Rodgers or Jesse Ventura, whoever he picks this week. But I'll leave you the
I
last
would,
word, John, before we head to break.
yeah, I would like to be considered in the how did you put it? The discombobulated group? Yeah,
Yeah, let's.
I'm feeling pretty discombobulated about this one myself. So, yeah, I don't know if we're gonna have the turnout we did in 2020 when and Trump's got a point.
I think we'll have the turnout for Trump supporters. It's the
Yes.
it, will the other people turn out to vote? Because
That's where I'm
Trump's
going.
pretty solid.
I don't think we're gonna have a turnout where the winner gets 80 million again and the loser gets whatever. I think Trump was near 78, around 77 and change. I don't know. My gut says the turnout won't be that large total, and I think that's a problem for Biden because of the enthusiasm.
Always.
Again, not just with the MAGA base, but within the whole Republican Party for Trump. I was on a call this week. Excuse me, I was on a call this week with some Biden campaign officials, and they're feeling at least publicly, they're feeling pretty confident in large part because
That's not what they
of
say
the fund.
privately, though.
I know fundraising advantage. They say this privately, but they also are starting to say this publicly. They expect this to be an extremely close race. They are not trying to project anything else. They're being honest about that. I mean, they're talking like this thing is going into overtime, and they're getting ready for that, those kinds of scenarios as well. I'll go with what to get the and they see polling that we don't see. They see a lot more
Yeah.
targeted and that's what they're preparing for. That they feel good about, the positives that they have right now, the fundraising. They think they have the better ground game in these swing states, and they're trying to build that right now. They're trying to really build that out right now. So when we get to the home stretch, especially in the swing states, that they've got the door knockers, they've got events going on. And right now, the Trump side really doesn't have that kind of ground game.
No, they
So
don't think
what
they
you
need
have
it.
emerged, yeah, what you, yeah, they don't need it because he is the ground game.
Yeah,
He's
he's
it.
it. I mean,
So
I
you're
look at
getting a
these states, and when I'm talking to people in these swing states, there's no Trump organization. There's plenty of Democratic. I mean, they're down grassroots. They're in
yeah.
the precincts. There's nothing from Trump, but he doesn't need it, and he
Doesn't.
doesn't have the money for it either. So we're going to leave it at that and take a short break. But I will say this to what you said, John, if it's as close as they say it is, they say publicly, if it's that close, what the hell is wrong with the Democratic Party that they can barely crawl over the low bar set by the Republicans? Think about that. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly edition of Looking at the News, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and, well, editor-at-large and chief White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. We left talking about Donald Trump. Let's talk a little bit about Congress. they did pass a budget, finally. It was signed into law by the president, finally. Look at the people that have vacated the Republican Party. We've had two this past week. And Marjorie Taylor Greene has called for a vote, called a question on the speaker. And I don't think she's thought that one through very much. But let's talk about the disarray of Congress a little bit. Like I said, they managed to get out a vote, but it was signed in the budget. But at the same time, with all these defectors, I think Gallagher was one of them. You can enlighten us a little bit there, John. The defectors and the Marjorie Taylor Greene move.
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene surprised everyone on Friday as House members were going about voting on this second large spending package for the fiscal year that started, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. But hey, they got it done. A lot of skeptics, cynics like me, didn't think they would get all 12 of these annual spending bills done, but they did. Funny thing happened on the way to doing so, however, when Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is among the most conservative members of the House, introduced a motion to vacate the speakership. And listeners probably remember, this is what happened to Kevin McCarthy, who's now not a member of Congress anymore and certainly not the speaker anymore. The difference here is, so they're upset with the spending deal. They think there's too much of it, too much spending. They have wanted deep, deep, deep spending cuts on everything, but the Pentagon budget, and some of them will tell you privately that they wouldn't mind cutting the Pentagon budget, but they don't say that publicly, at least not a lot. So they want deep spending cuts. They didn't get it. Johnson did what every speaker that I've covered has done. He and his, you know, he picked a couple lead negotiators and they got together with House Democratic leaders and Senate leaders from both parties in the White House. And they finished these spending bills behind the scenes, closed door negotiations. That frustrates all members, but it really frustrates the hardline conservatives. So she introduced a motion to vacate the speakership to kick Mike Johnson out of the speakership. She essentially says, you know, he's gone native. He's just another speaker. The difference.
I like the idea of gone native, but yes. go ahead.
It happens.
There's a visual there that we don't want to.
Yeah, the difference is that this isn't privileged, which is a process. It's not privileged yet. Yeah. When Matt Gaetz introduced his resolution to kick Kevin McCarthy out of the speakership, it was privileged, meaning the House had to hold a vote on the resolution within two legislative days. She did not ask Friday for this to be privileged.
So she's they got don't 2 weeks ever, to whip right. the votes and then yes. come back and ask for it.
And she says that she said this is a warning, but she can reintroduce it if he does something else. And when they come back after this 2 week Easter break, he probably will do something that frustrates the conservatives. Then she could ask for it to be privileged. Then they would have to vote on it.
And my question is, and Michael, I'd love to hear your opinion on this one. Look, you got Mike Gallagher who's quitting. You've got Senator Lisa Murkowski, who says she's aghast at Donald Trump's candidacy and the direction of her party, can't rule out bolting from the GOP. So you've got people flowing away from the GOP, fleeing the GOP, decreasing the number of their majority in the House. And does I wonder if Marjorie Taylor Greene has seen the end game and understands that that could end, you could not only lose your majority, but you could end up with Hakeem Jeffries as the Speaker of the House.
So what does this mean, though? This has the majority at a one vote majority. Does that mean if one more Republican were to leave the Republican Party, whether by not caucusing with them or quitting altogether, is a tie? Is there a tie? It's an odd number in the House.
Well,
Is
what will
how,
happen is they
when does when does the majority switch from one party to another party in this Congress?
John?
I'm not sure. I think we're getting down to about where I think it's going to be basically a one seat majority,
Yeah.
one or two seat majority. The number is it's really close. I mean, they're not going to pass, where it's a five seat or a one seat, it doesn't really matter when they go vote because there's
No,
enough.
but John, I'm not asking about the voting. Sorry. They keep saying there's a one vote, he has a one vote majority. What I couldn't figure out or didn't take the time to properly figure out, does that mean that the Republicans have literally one more member of Congress than the Democrats have? And that if they were to
Yes.
lose one more
Yes.
member, then what happens? Is it what's the number of Congress people? Is it 436? Is it an even number?
Well,
It's
what will
435.
happen is
Mm-hmm.
what's going to happen is, I mean, remember that the majority or the Speaker of the House could be from the minority party.
No, I know. I'm
Yeah.
not asking any of those
But you're
questions. Just
asking
more so
about like how would you
your.
have who would be the heads of the committees because those
No,
are basically
I'm not asking
majority
that at
commit.
all. No, I'm not trying to ask that. I'm trying to ask if there, how many congressmen are there? 435 congressmen? 436? What's the number of congressmen? And
There you
how many do each does each party have? So I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, they keep saying a one
435
vote,
members.
435. So how many Republicans and how many Democrats are in this current
Well,
435?
it's not that simple because this will like Gallagher leaving will take it down to 217 Republicans, but then there will be a special election
No,
in a
no, no,
month
no.
or so.
And I get that. I get that. But it
You
is
could
so.
have a scenario where, yes, you could have a scenario where on April 19th, Republicans are in the majority to leave, and on April 20th, Democrats are in the majority. Then you have three special elections that are in safe red districts, and then on June 4th, Republicans take back the majority. You
Yeah, I
could have that
understand.
scenario.
Well, that's the scenario that I'm trying to flesh out. Because I
That's
mean, you've got
218 right from the Republican minus one, 217. The minority party, the Democrats, have 213. There are four vacant seats. So at the end of the day, it could be a if those four vacant seats, right? Well, now five. It could flip, and it could if the Democrats win them all.
Yes,
If
this,
not, the
yes.
Republicans would hold on. But right now, with the membership of the House being light, there's just a one vote majority.
So if one if there were one less Republican and a Democrat called the vote, I mean, because anyone I guess can call under the rules that McCarthy set in place, any one person can call the vote. If one person were to leave, do the Democrats then, if they vote in lockstep, have the numbers to flip the control of the House?
That's the question. That's why Marjorie Taylor Greene is playing with dynamite, because there are even disaffected Republicans who might vote for Hakeem
Well,
Jeffries.
that's right. That's the question I'm asking. That's the
Yeah, there's
and it
four or
may
five of them
and
who
you
might do it just for vengeance.
and you say it may be, John says correctly, that it may be that it only lasts for 3 months
Yeah.
until the special elections, but that would be a fun 3 months, I can tell you.
Yes.
Now you guys might remember, I've never seen that scenario happen with the House, but I have covered a Senate or two, I think two Senates that in the middle of a session for this very reason, flip back and forth. literally in the same session, multiple times, you had Majority Leader McConnell and Majority Leader Harry Reid, and they traded the gavel as the year went on, and then you had special elections and governors appointing senators, and it was crazy because you went to a hearing one day, and John McCain was the ranking member, and you went back the next Tuesday, and he was the chairman, and then 2 months later, Carl Levin was the chairman again, right?
Well,
So it was,
that's exactly what I was trying to get at.
yeah, that
How
has happened
close?
in the Senate. I've never seen it happen in the House, and the House is obviously is a lot more chaotic place. So you can imagine how noisy and just politically filthy that would be.
Well, and to your speaking there, John, it'd be like the
It could happen.
WWE. We'd be looking at a SmackDown. Let's
We would. And what could happen is you could have a scenario where someone where I mean, this is kind of West Wing stuff, the old television show, which did not age well. Our politics changed. That show is it's hard to watch now. But you could have a scenario, for instance, where she brings this motion to vacate back, asks for it to be privileged, and some Republican lawmaker who's just frustrated, like Ken Buck, who's leaving, Gallagher, who's leaving, they just throw their hands up and say, "I'm out of here Friday." And they have to vote on this thing, and so that individual's gone, and Democrats stay together, and Hakeem Jeffries is the speaker. I mean,
Right. And then they
that could
pass the
happen.
Ukrainian bill. They
Yeah,
pass the Israeli bill.
that's
They
maybe. Who
bring all
knows?
those things that Johnson refused to bring to the floor, and the
Yeah.
Senate passes it in the next day, and Biden signs it. And it just could be so interesting to watch from a pure, entertainment standpoint.
I think it's hilarious that the people that are claiming that, Congress is broken, they're the ones who broke it. I mean, come on. The far right is screaming loud right now because there's even a farther right than the far right now.
There is, and she is part of it. She is part of that faction, the Matt Gaetz, Lauren Boebert, even though she and Boebert don't get along at all. Excuse me, they are part of that far right faction.
Before we go to break, I want to get to one other thing. Ron McDaniel just got hired and is going to MSNBC. And I want to tell you that as a reporter who spent my life in this field, I know lots of qualified reporters, commentators, anchors that have a journalism background who want to do what's right. And they're looking at this hire going, I can't get a job, but an election denier, basically a propagandist for Donald Trump, does get hired. And I know that my inclination is go to you, John, first, but I'm going to go outside of the realm of journalism and ask Michael, how do you look at it? How do you think the viewing public looks at it when you've got a propagandist being hired by, instead of doing real news, we're just going to
Well,
spew propaganda because that's where the
I'm
money
not sure if
is.
that's where the money is, because I'm expecting that MSNBC is going to start bleeding viewers over
Well,
this.
that's where they think the money. They didn't make
No, I
this
get it,
decision for
but
anything other than
I
money.
don't know whether they calculated it properly. But I think that there are a lot of former Trump communications people who are on TV. There's some for CNN at the moment, and maybe MSNBC is trying to play catch up. But I honestly think that they don't represent a legitimate point of view that merits a position on mainstream television. If you are still a propagandist, then you don't belong on national television, whether it be cable or broadcast. I just think it's a very wrong headed decision to do. If you want someone to be on television to represent the pluses that a Trump candidacy and presidency would present to the country, there are a lot of serious people who believe that, and those people can be hired, and you can have a serious discussion about whether Trump's isolationism, or his tax policy or his immigration policy or his whatever policy is better or worse than Biden's. But to bring someone on who has not lived in the, in my view, the realm of reality for so long, to have her come on, and what is she going to say? Well, now that I'm on TV, just like the, what's the name, McElhaney, who's on CNN, who was a, yeah.
Kayleigh
Well, I'm
McEnany,
not
another
going to
moron.
call her anything other than, you know, the
Well, I'll call her a moron. I was in the briefing room with her. She's a propagandist. She has never spewed a fact. She never gave a briefing where she didn't spew baloney and try to tell us we were the fake news while she was providing fake news.
The first
Nonsense.
briefing she did
Huh?
was a serious briefing. The boss didn't like it. And then, yes, Brian, she did a metamorphosis within
Yeah.
24 hours.
Yeah, she said she'd never
Right. So
lie
what
to
I'm
us,
saying
and
is
then
that
she did.
people
I'm sorry, go ahead,
like
Michael.
her, like Sean Spitzer, like Rona McDaniel, Spicer, whatever his name is, Spicer, Spitzer. I get those two confused, the governor and the press secretary. Both dislikable in my view. But you know, I just don't think they, I just don't like these hires. I don't think that they advance honest discourse. And they may be good entertainment in a WWE sense of things, but that's not what I view as the obligation of an FCC licensee or a mainstream news organization. It's we're not they shouldn't be in the food fight business, and they shouldn't be hiring propagandists. They should be hiring people who can allow us to the listening audience to hear the discussion in sober terms and make our own decision for ourselves. I just think it's a very bad look.
And John, I'll give you the last word on that before we head to the break.
Well, this is not a positive development, really, by any means. For the media, it's this pursuit of balance for the sake of it almost. It's overreaching toward that goal. There are plenty of, reasonable but conservative analyst out there that if they wanted to make a splash, I don't I Chris Christie, when he announced his run for president, ABC rightly ended their relationship with him. I don't know if he was gettable, but Chris, he's a big name. If they I understand the impulse here to bring on a big name from the right. It's an election year. You want that perspective on your air. I get that. But she was deposed. There's video out there. Anybody can go listen to it. She went along with the big lie, and efforts to overturn the election. She defended it. And I just don't understand why MSNBC would go this direction. I mean, just watch Morning Joe on any given day. Watch Nicole Wallace in the afternoon. Nicole Wallace's show is basically about January 6th and the effort to overturn the election. Morning Joe, they talk about that. When I catch an hour or so every day, I listen to it because the president listens to it. So I want to know what's going into his mind. They talk about all that stuff too. The whole network is heavily critical about the big lie and January 6th, and McDaniel has defended it all. It's a head scratcher. But Brian, we were talking about this the other day. It's all about money. And as Eric Bischoff, you tweeted this, we were at the White House. Eric Bischoff was the executive director of the old WCW Professional Wrestling Company, and he wrote a book about how he booked the card every night, and he tried to make it as controversial as possible. And his book is entitled Controversy Creates Cash. That's what they're really up to here, is try to get people to tune in, or you're flipping around, and let's see what Ronna McDaniel has to say about the latest Trump rally. It's a huge gamble, and they are getting roasted on social media. There's a lot of They're just getting absolutely roasted, but
Well,
it's from where you would expect. The roasting is coming from the left, I just think they could have found a big name within the Republican ranks and checked that box, because they do need more of that. I'll be very honest. MSNBC needs more of that perspective on its programming. I just don't think this was the way to accomplish that.
And with that said, we're going to take a break. But while we were talking, Vanity Fair just broke an article that says Ronna McDaniel won't be appearing on MSNBC. That just days after it was she was hired, NBC's president Rashida Jones told employees that the former Republican National Committee chairman won't be contributing on air to the cable network. I don't know if that means she'll be contributing off air or not. She has been hired, and in a memo announcing her hiring, Carrie Budoff Brown, who leads NBC's elections reporting, wrote that, quote, "It couldn't be a more important moment to have a voice like Ronna's on the team."
So with will that not, said, so they looks like we're now, still she's up. Not going to be on the air?
Well, I thought that, air, no, but I thought that looking at the same thing as it says that she'll be a presence on NBC News Now, the streaming platform.
Yeah, the streaming platform, but she won't be on MSNBC. So they're going to give her a smaller venue, but they're keeping her around. That's their way of backing away, of reacting.
Wasn't she on Meet? Wasn't she on Meet the Press this morning?
Let's not go there. That's an hour's conversation.
She's good on the digital side, and if she resonates, if
then
the
they'll graduate her up
like
to
her,
the,
then yeah. This is about Big J journalism, but. I've said, let's be honest, this is about money. And if she's good on digital, she'll find her way to cable. And if she's good on cable, she'll find her way to the big peacock, to the big network. That's just how it works.
Yeah. So with that, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask a Question, and I am your host, Brian Caron. We've covered a lot of ground today, folks. With me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large and White House correspondent, senior White House correspondent from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. And guys, when we left, we were talking about Ronna Barrett. Let's talk a little bit about the two questions that were asked this week. I know I asked them, but the U.S. ceasefire was vetoed at the U.N., and the U.S. had vetoed a ceasefire plan in the Middle East proposed by Hamas a month ago. So my question to John Kirby was, what's the difference between our veto and theirs? And he said, well, ours was done for policy reasons, and China and Russia vetoed ours for political reasons. Does that resonate? And is that an accurate description of
what
occurred,
Michael? I have no idea.
Michael?
That's
a good answer.
I have no idea why, if there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza and there's a ceasefire on the table, even if it's not, you know, perfect, do you let the perfect be the enemy of good? If there is starvation and there is going to be even worse civilian calamity, why not try this, even again, if it's not the perfect outcome? So I don't understand what the. I
so
don't
why
know.
Do we
That's
veto it in
I,
February?
I don't know the answer to your question on either bookend of the vetoes. I don't completely understand. I just don't understand it. I know it's a complicated calculus. I understand that. But if what is represented as true is true, and I have no reason to believe that it isn't true, that people are starving to death, kids are dying from starvation. This is Somalia or other places that we've seen in our history for goodness sake, why let policy, if you will, at a geopolitical level, interfere with feeding starving children? I don't get it. I don't get it, Brian, on either side. I'm sure John Bennett, who's smarter than both of us together, knows the answer to this off the top of his head. But I'm clueless.
I know not of who. I don't recognize that gentleman that
John.
you referenced there, Michael. I don't know why we're ping-ponging UN resolution vetoes back and forth. I just I'm baffled at the administration at the onset of this on October 7th or 8th, not anticipating that, especially with a green light and a blank check of permission from the White House, that Benjamin Netanyahu would do exactly what he has done and is doing. I certainly knew that he was going to respond, and once he responded and got his troops ready and activated and in place, that he was going to execute a very brutal military operation inside Gaza. I knew that he was not going to hold back very much. I knew that he was going to tell civilian populations to go in X direction, and then he was going to send his troops there. I don't know why the White House, at least publicly, and the reporting about behind the scenes matches, did not anticipate this. And now they're frustrated. They're frustrated, and it's a problem in part of their own creation, I think. And and I'll be honest, when they express frustration, I don't have much sympathy for the situation, and analyzing it. I just think they could have been more forceful, especially in their public statements, because that does matter. Netanyahu, he's in political trouble, his political future. So that public pressure from the White House to hold back, or with the starvation campaign, well, this has been going on really the whole time, and now the White House is trying to do something about it, and it feels like, too little, too late. And it's baffling that they were so caught off guard by the Israel's conduct of the war, and their tactics, and how brutal they're being, because I think it was pretty easy to predict how this was going to play out.
Well, I'll say this much. To Michael's point and to yours, I think the administration has created its own problems in this regard. And for them to say that it's politics from Russia and China, of course it's politics, but I don't know that ours wasn't. If we vetoed it, our veto of a Hamas proposal didn't give us everything that we wanted exactly. I get it. But the art of half a loaf, isn't it better to have a ceasefire and let the starving people be fed? And let some progress be made and then negotiate further from a position of strength, i.e. a ceasefire. And those are questions that I don't think any of us have a good answer to because of the fog of war of information coming out of the Middle East. But I damn sure on the face of it want to ask this government, why is it seems hypocritical to veto a ceasefire? And then to be upset because your ceasefire was vetoed. To me, it looks like all of this is politics, and the people on the ground, both Israelis and Palestinians, who have nothing to do other than trying to live their daily life, are still suffering. And that, to me, is the biggest pile of crap in the entire thing to have to deal with. And speaking of piles of crap, I'm going to pivot for our last discussion, the fire and the and what occurred in Russia this past week. The other question I asked in the briefing room of Kirby on Friday was whether or not the and now I think there's what 113 confirmed dead at a concert by terrorists backed by ISIS apparently in Moscow, and they set the venue on fire. It's one of the worst acts of terrorism in Russian history. And I asked on Friday, is it does it show an instability in the Russian regime? That question is now being asked, and there have been several articles. I realize I may have been the first to ask it, but certainly won't be the last, because weeks after his re-election, Putin is facing this type of scrutiny and this trouble. And he's turned around and blamed, of course, Ukraine for it, and says he'll vow to find who did it and put him to death or whatever. But let's talk about that a little bit. Do you think that that shows, I mean, it shows the volatility of the world, but John, I'll start with you. Does it show volatility and questionable activity in Russia? And is that regime
The
shaky?
regime is somewhat shaky. I mean, they just had an election, and not surprisingly, Mr. Putin won, more power and extended his term. So it is shaky. There is a lot of internal distrust and disapproval of Putin. The war in Ukraine is not popular inside Russia. So he has these challenges, and now he has this attack, which is just going to further erode that trust. And how did this happen? It's a very good question. We know from reporting from our colleague Steve Holland of Reuters and others that the U.S. a few weeks ago had this information, had this intelligence information, and actually took it to the Russian government. And said that this kind of attack, there was chatter that was picked up about this very kind of attack. It doesn't seem like the Russian government increased security at these types. This was a concert hall and shopping mall. It was, I think, a kind of a multi-use, multi-use venue. I haven't seen anything that the Russians have stepped up security at these kinds of places. So they're going to face scrutiny. And we've seen huge protests in major Russian cities before. We could be headed back to that. And that always makes folks nervous when you have a nuclear armed former superpower with a lot of internal bad feelings and a shaky regime. And we know about the Putin government, when it feels pressure internally, it acts out. And there will be an impulse here, I think, to act out in some way. And he's probably thinking about this right now inside the Kremlin. How is this going to play long term? Are the folks going to hit the streets next weekend in St. Petersburg and Moscow and voice their disapproval? And when that happens, we'll see how Putin responds. But we've definitely seen this before. And it's a big cause for concern right now.
There you go, Michael.
Look, acts of terrorism are bad, period, wherever they occur. And the reality is that the superpowers have precious little ability to control it. And we're all vulnerable, which, of course, always leads to we need to act as a League of Nations collectively in those areas. Yeah,
Or
or
the
where
United
we
Nations.
have, more opportunity for agreement than disagreement. Then, it's a pox on everybody's house that we can't figure out how to act collectively, and marginalize those who would engage in this type of terrorism. It's a failure on a global level, and there's no one who's immune from it. And the leadership of so many countries leaves so much to be desired, that this is, foreseeable, for the future. And, no amount of security or so-called retributive bombings to get even is going to make a whit of difference. We in America,
No, I think it increases the chances of more
so there you
terrorism.
are. So it's like the immigration debate.
Yeah.
You could put up a wall around the country 100 feet tall, and people will still find a way to get in if the
Ladders and
conditions
tunnels.
that they are fleeing are so desperate that they have no choice but to leave. And if we don't look at the underlying causes of why people are leaving, if we look at don't look at the underlying causes of the situation we find ourselves with respect to terrorism, then there's no hope for a solution. You can't bomb people back into the Stone Age and expect it to be successful. We saw that, for a century in Afghanistan. We can't think that we can somehow build a border wall and keep people who are fleeing countries like Haiti and Ecuador and Venezuela that are in very difficult situation in no small measure because of global economic policy. And so, you can either decide to be part of a solution and correct these on the ground situations that cause people to do these things, or you can just keep putting band-aids over cuts that will never heal.
Yeah, one.
There you go. And violence is the last refuge of the incompetent, spoketh
One way that
Isaac
Putin,
Asimov. Go ahead,
yeah,
John.
one way
I'll
Putin
let you
can
have the
act
last
out
word.
is to be even more brutal in how he's conducting the war in Ukraine. And I think he already
And that he
has. There
will.
were some attacks yesterday that even more civilian deaths, and we know they've targeted non-military targets. They've targeted civilian targets, and I think that happened again yesterday, and I think that'll continue to happen, and that's very troubling. I did see one report of the from Russia from inside Russia that Putin now claims that the attackers tried to escape into Ukraine, so that already building a justification for stepping up the brutality there. And again, very very predictable, very on brand for Putin, but Ukraine needs that aid, but it's not coming out of Congress anytime soon, I think.
Because if you are a terrorist and you're
Right.
with ISIS, where's the best place to flee but to another war-torn country and get bombed there? Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But at the end of the day, I'll take the final lap here. At the end of the day, it's frightening to me, and to quote Michael, and we'll end it up on an up note with that. It's frightening to me that we don't understand that that what we do does not contribute to a solution, but only contributes to further violence. And there will be further violence, and at some point in time, you have to hope that world leaders wake the fuck up. But maybe not. So with that said, what a positive note. I'll let you give your plug away, John.
Well, I
What's
will
up? And
say
how can we
that
catch you?
that was action packed. We're finished. I didn't realize that. That went really really fast. That was a good time. Another busy week, even though Congress is on recess. I'm sure we'll get an update or two about the motion to vacate the speakership. We've got the president on the road most of the week. He's back on the campaign trail, and we've got more Donald Trump in court, at least for a day, I think, this week. So you can follow along. All that will keep you updated at rollcall.gov.
Michael, it's your turn.
So the
Plug away,
podcast
my
is
brother.
called That Said with Michael Zeldin. And as everyone knows now, we interview authors about books. We just interestingly distributed a book interview with a woman named Martha McPhee about her childhood. And it has so many interesting components to it, from Yasgur's farm of Woodstock days to the Me Too movement. It's a definite worth listening to. And this coming week, we're going to be talking to Jeffrey Rosen, the head of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, about his new book, The Pursuit of Happiness, and what that meant to the founding fathers. Very different than the hedonists' explanation of what the pursuit of happiness means. And so I invite people to listen and join. And of course, to end on a good news note, baseball season 4 days away.
Woohoo! So the name of the show is Just Ask the Question. Once again, I am your host, Brian Karam, and thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.